I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. According to the National Security Reporter with the Washington Post, quote, most American soldiers think of peacekeeping as but a step away from utter chaos and two steps from combat. Hannah Priest concluded years ago that even the most skilled soldiers are not the best peacekeepers. She has seen their frustrations and failures up close in Kosovo and Afghanistan. Now in Iraq, she says the same lessons are being learned all over again. There is one proposed solution. It's now in the form of a bill to be introduced in the Senate that she says will go a long way towards solving a number of these problems. Hannah Priest calls it a new Peace Corps, a place where ordinary Americans can volunteer their skills as engineers and police, teachers and technicians. And so what would you think about a chance like that to help out? Would you go to Haiti, to Kosovo? Would you go to Iraq? If you didn't have to enlist but still wanted to help out on the ground? Or do you think that war zones are no place for unarmed, untrained civilians and that such work is and should be the domain of the UN and other NGOs? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the National Security Reporter with the Washington Post, Dana Priest. Her book, The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military, is now out in paperback with some additions, bringing it right up to speed. Dana, nice to have you here on the program.
Glad to be here, Dick.
There's a story you tell in the introduction to the book about walking down the street in Vitina, Kosovo. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
And you get beckoned into this small store. What happens?
Well, a woman steps out from a storefront. I'm walking with a platoon of infantrymen from the 82nd Airborne, and she probably figures I'm with them because they've made me put on a helmet and Kevlar. And they ask me to come in. She does. And I walk in the door, and there's a room full of Serb women who really, to be there in an Albanian-controlled town, really risked their lives getting there. And at the head of the table was an Albanian lawyer. And they explained to me, I brought a lieutenant with me, they explained to me that they had come together to write a Bill of Rights, and they hand it over, and a translator starts to translate it, and it is a Bill of Rights. It says, we're Serb women, we're coming together, risking our lives to do so, we deserve to live in peace and justice and to raise our families and to provide for them. It goes on, and at the end it says, what we really need are 4 sewing machines. And with these sewing machines, we'll start a sewing cooperative. And the wares will provide for our family, and we're willing to leave our homes to do this. Can you please give this to the battalion commander who is in charge of the general area? So, as a reporter, I'm not supposed to be in the story, and I hand it off to the lieutenant. And the next day, I went over to the battalion commander, and I said, did you get a piece of paper yesterday from some women in Vitina? And he said, yeah, sewing machines. We're the U.S. Army. We don't do sewing machines. It really, and they don't. They try hard, but some things are just out of the scope of what they do or what they even think about doing.
Now, a little bit later on, also in Kosovo, you are quoting the commander of Task Force Falcon, Brigadier General John Craddock. And he says, I guess to you, look, oh, no, maybe he's saying it back home. Maybe you can tell me. Look, he says, this is going to be an unmitigated disaster if we don't figure out how to fix some things. We've got no law and order, no civil works.
That is John Craddock, who is very upset that his command in Germany has sent him to Kosovo with a traditional military combat unit, thinking that they might, 2 months after the war ended, that they might actually see some combat. And what they didn't do is think about the people within the military who are the best suited for nation building. Those would be the civil affairs. And he's having to yell at them to convince them that he needs different types of people here. He needs civil affairs. He needs more intelligence officers. He needs medics and he needs MPs because really, in that situation, you don't need infantrymen. You need police. And he's trying to convince them that that's the case.
The point to me is that from the women who are requesting sewing machines to very senior officers, the message is pretty consistent and ought to have been heard sometime before this time last year when the Army went back into Iraq. And yet, I don't know, I guess it was April of last year, we have the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, saying to the foreign aid agencies, stay out. we'll handle the aid. We'll handle it all. It's like nobody's turning the page back to see what happened the year before, the battle before. Did you see it the same way?
Oh, exactly. In fact, there were many officers who had been in Haiti and Somalia and Bosnia and Kosovo, had a wealth of experience, and who were very eager to help Rumsfeld and his inner circle understand the lessons that they had learned and to do better. But they really shut them out. They really shut them out. And they conceived of a post-war era in which you didn't need to provide much security. And you saw the looting, you saw the raiding of arms depots, all sorts of things. And they thought they'd be welcomed with open arms. It was amazing, not only to me, who had written this about Kosovo, but to many, it was very demoralizing to many army officers and to the civilian experts who thought, we have knowledge, we should be doing this. And of course, they got shut out too. So we are still dealing with the situation that is very insecure, in part because they didn't learn lesson number one, which is, you have to provide security first before you can expect anybody else to come in, and or before you can even expect the Iraqis to go about their business of trying to set up and establish a new society.
Okay, well, fast forward to right now, because this group of thinkers gathered together by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee actually came up with some answers to this. Now, I don't know how you regard this, Dana. You must see a ton of paper cross your desk every day covering the beat that you do. But was this a big idea, or do you think this is a big idea whose time might have come?
Absolutely. I don't necessarily think there's the political leadership to make it happen. But there is a coalescence of both Republicans and Democrats on the idea that really, we send the military to do nation building, not because anybody decides that they are the best people to do it, but because there is no alternative. So let's think about creating an alternative. And what Senator Lugar, a Republican, and Senator Biden, a Democrat, have done is first they brought together various think tanks that had their own projects on this reconstruction project notion, and got them to give them testimony and expert witness testimony and what have you. And they have introduced a bill now that has, or they're about to introduce it. It's passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee unanimously 2 weeks ago. And it would set up a civilian coordinator for the civilian arm of the U.S. government, which is really one of the problems. The military is so well organized because of what it is and the hierarchy it has. The civilian side of the government is very disorganized, a lot of infighting, a lot of turf battles, and a general lack of accountability or efficiency in doing these kinds of emergency, high-intensity, demanding jobs. So they think that you need first a coordinator who can sit on top of the U.S. government's existing organizations and figure out how best to use them, but also to begin to think about creating a core of people, I think they call it a reconstruction core, who could be on call either as reservists, and I say, you know, why not full-time, but as reservists who could come in and take over the minute you don't need troops anymore. Or you could even conceive them in a place like Iraq where you have an insurgency. You wouldn't want them doing counterinsurgency. You need the army to continue to do that. But
Let's say you've got a broken water main on a street in Baghdad. Right now you've got six soldiers with their sleeves rolled up down in the ditch trying to fix the water main and figuring out how to do that because it wasn't in the book that they studied. And another two or three standing at the top of the hole with their guns making sure that these guys are protected. Am I simplifying it too much to say, if something like this were to happen, then you'd actually have, you know, civilian engineers, water experts helping get that done in half the time without all with maybe just a couple of soldiers to make sure that they had the security. Do we think about it in that way?
Well, the people who are proposing this do. The government doesn't yet. And the other thing that you, in the reconstruction area, reconstructing water, phone systems, electricity, Those things are even the more black and white situations. What you really need in the very beginning as well is a transitional justice system so that somebody will be taking the bad guys off the streets. You need police. And then you need to put them in a judicial system that is temporary while you're figuring out how the Iraqis are going to set their own system up. So you need sort of the portable judicial system that can deal with the bad actors. And again, it's a way to make people feel safe. If you want people to participate ultimately in a political system, for people like the Iraqis who've been repressed in that regard for so long, that's a risk-taking mindset that they need to adapt, and you need to make them feel that they can do that. And I think the best way to do that is with civilians. There are so many NGOs and so many governments who are experts in doing this, but who are not well coordinated to do it.
Let's take our first call from Beaufort, South Carolina. D.C. is joining us on the line. D.C., thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you think? You ready to sign up?
No, unfortunately. And I served both in the Peace Corps in Kenya as well as Haiti. And while I was there in both countries, there was an attempted coup. And I felt very unsafe, first of all, because there's no training that you receive. Certainly I had the expertise to help the country develop itself, but there's no training you receive to protect yourself. We have no ammunition. If someone wanted to attack us or...
Yeah, but once you're carrying a gun, D.C., then you might as well be wearing a uniform and you might as well be a part of the Army, right?
Yes, and that's very true. And I think one of the core issues you have to really look at, having served as a Peace Corps volunteer, the key word is trust. There's a trust that you are not there infiltrating America views in the sense that you're trying to change their political system or be CIA. We were very, very strong. We're here to work. We aren't getting involved in politics or anything of that nature. We're only here to work. And once you start aligning yourself with the military, it becomes a whole different issue. And I think you have to be very careful, particularly if you're there genuinely to help the country to develop, not to confuse the two things.
And, Dana, that's part of the way that this would be set up. These people would not be in uniform. They wouldn't be with the military, would they?
Right. And the other difference is, in Iraq, we are trying to be involved with the political system in the sense that we are trying to help the Iraqis create an entirely new one. So it's not like the Peace Corps that he's talking about, and nor do I think it should be. I think it should be different. What we have now is two sides of the spectrum. On one side, we have the military who are doing these missions by default because we have no one else. On the other side, we have a traditional diplomatic corps who wear pinstripe suits and meet at the highest levels in embassies and cocktail parties, and they use a... you know, patience and calm and behind-the-scenes negotiation. What you need to do peacekeeping is a totally different personality. You need a risk-taker. You need somebody who can coordinate in the chaos of developing a civil society.
And certainly over the last 2.5 years, a lot of people have sent us emails here at the program saying, boy, I wish I had been asked. Are you one of those people? Do you think this is an idea whose time has come? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Dana Priest is my guest. She's national security reporter with the Washington Post. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio this hour, Dana Priest. She is Washington Post's national security reporter, author of a book called The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. We're talking this hour about an idea that she's got her eye on in Washington as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee moves towards full Senate consideration of a new bill that would create something, I think they call it, what is it, Dana, rapid report response or something like that. I like your name for it, a sort of Peace Corps for the 21st century. No criticism of the current Peace Corps intended, but talking about the ongoing gap that the military can't seem to fill in taking care of civil affairs. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Somerville now. And Joe's on the line. Joe, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm just wondering if our having an institutionalized peacekeeping force would make it make it us less timid about invading countries to begin with. And if it should, I mean, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe the aftermath that we face would give us a little bit more pause if we weren't so prepared to take care of things afterwards.
That's a good question. The better the U.S. gets at it, the more it does. Dennis nodding.
Well, actually, that's been one of the arguments against it for many years, that not only if you build it, they will come. In other words, other nations will also sort of expect the United States to step in during times of chaos when the United States may not find it, you know, in their interest to do that. But in your suggestion as well, the problem is because those arguments prevailed, the U.S. government has just failed. They're sort of in denial. And time again, they are using the military because they haven't been willing to step forward and do something different. I think these days we all see the cost of peacekeeping and nation building and the duration of these missions. And that is sobering. And I think that it would be sobering for political leaders as well, that even if you wanted to do this, there is a tremendous economic cost to doing it, and that that would be an overriding concern of theirs.
There's a story in today's Washington Post, Dana, about a woman by the name of Fern Holland, 33-year-old lawyer from Washington, who was one of the civilians killed in a car in south of Baghdad a couple of days ago. Peace Corps volunteer in 1999, worked in schools, helping women with sexual abuse issues in Guinea. I mean, she's got a resume that has taken her around the world helping people out. And that's what she was doing in Iraq. She wasn't wearing a uniform. She was doing the sort of thing that we're talking about. And so I'm reading her story and thinking to myself, maybe the military has to do this. Maybe nobody but the people carrying guns can live and work in a situation like that.
Well, the military is being targeted as well, and that's because we have to go back to that same first lesson, security first. And Iraq is fighting an insurgency like we did not have to fight in Bosnia or Kosovo or Haiti or Somalia until the end of that mission. So you do have in Iraq just this parallel course that is very difficult to manage, and you wouldn't want to send people to areas in Iraq that were totally not secure. You'd also want to have still some sort of military rapid reaction force and some kind of presence that could respond. But fundamentally, you would have to take risks like those people do when they come to urban America and work in our inner cities. You are always going to take some casualties.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Todd is with us. Todd, thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
I'm leaving for Iraq on the 14th, actually Monday, and I'm a National Guard soldier. There's such a wealth of knowledge, I think, that the military is overlooking by using the National Guard people that have, myself have a degree in engineering, and there's people like that could be taking care of the water mains, people taking care of training these police officers that are here in the United States. I think it's being overlooked that the military still has this mind of it still being a war going on there.
Todd, just stay with us on the line. Don't hang up. I think it's a great question. I mean, he's, in a way, Dana, he's saying it's there now, isn't it, as the National Guard?
Yes, it is. But as his point is, they are being fit into units that are basically combat, organized for combat. However, the civil affairs units are a great example of what the Guard and Reserve gives, because 80 or 90% of civil affairs units are made up of Guard and Reservists for that specific reason. The problem is there just aren't enough. Civil affairs has always been a second-class type of job within the Army if you want to be in it for a career. And so as a result, there were never that many units available. They have taxed many of them, all of them now. Same with the military police units, because they are the most appropriate for this sort of situation. They've been drawing on military police. But they did that in Kosovo and Bosnia. Mm-hmm. They've been doing that for the last 10 years, and they keep repeating it as if it's a surprise that those are the units that are really in demand, instead of increasing the number of police, military police, which they've started to do. But I think the point is well taken. And they are using those people to some degree, as he suggests, but it's almost on an ad hoc basis. You know, where are the engineers in this unit? You know, you try to pull them together instead of having them become part of the civil affairs or a civil reconstruction corps within the Army, which is the other alternative. If you don't want civilians to do it, should you create within the Army a nation-building force? Well, the Army hates that idea for the reason the other caller suggested. They will be the ones that will be continually deployed. And the Army still is made up of men, the leaders of the Army, who come from the combat arms sections, artillery, armor, and infantry. And they have the biggest weapons, they have the biggest budgets, and these other types of jobs have always been seen as sort of second-tier job. So it would be a cultural mindset shift for the Army itself, something they would not do by themselves. They would have to be mandated to change in that direction.
Todd, let me ask you a question. If you had a choice between joining a civilian force as an engineer, say something that might be under State Department, would go into a place like Iraq with protection, but you're not part of that protection, would that appeal to you any more or less than taking your skills in as a National Guardsman?
Well, I think it'd be a lot more useful. Over the last 6 months, I've trained as if there's still a war going on there with all infantry tactics, not as any civil affairs.
That's such an interesting point, too, because there isn't a traditional war that would be fought by the infantry going on anyway. There's a counterinsurgency, but they actually are not using the counterinsurgency forces that they have, which are the special operations forces. They are using conventional units to fight that as well. So even in the war setting, it's a little bit off the mark.
Todd, you're out on Monday. Keep your head down, will you?
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling in. Let's bring Nathaniel Raymond into the conversation. Nathaniel Raymond works with Oxfam. It's a relief organization that is on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nathaniel's just come back to Boston after meetings in Jordan, talking about Iraq with the CPA and the UN mission there. Nathaniel's been listening in. He's joining us on the line. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me what you guys were talking about in Jordan. Are you scratching your heads over just how you're going to get back in and get involved?
Well, the main question right now is, what is the situation for the UN and for NGOs going to look like as we approach the magic handover date of July 1st?
All right.
And the real focus among NGOs right now, for those of us who are still in the country in some capacity, is figuring out what a possible reintroduction of the UN is going to mean for as far as coordination of activities moving forward into this next phase. And there's question marks all over the map, Dick. It's a very uncertain time, and I think no one has any sort of silver bullet answer about how to proceed.
If there had been a more clearly defined civilian force kind of paving the way over the past few months, would that make it easier for you to do the kind of planning, or are we talking about the kind of work that the UN might have been doing?
Well, I would say that the absence of the traditional UN coordination role in this conflict, known as UN OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance, has been a huge problem. Traditionally, the UN does play what we could call a glove box role, creating that civil military space that's critical for NGOs to maintain their neutrality and be able to be seen by local civilians as impartial actors. That was the UN's job in conflict after conflict. And it's one piece of the pie, but it's a critical piece of the pie. And missing that in Iraq, for reasons which are both internal political reasons at the UN and external political reasons related to the way the U.S. conducted this lead up to the invasion and the invasion itself, has left many NGOs high and dry and forced into a position we never want to be in, which is direct contact and coordination with the military. That puts us at risk. And many people that I spoke to within the CPA and others really are frustrated by that and think that NGOs are being unrealistic, are being abstract by saying, you know, we need to have that space between us and military actors. But for us, it's not an abstract concept. It's a question of life and death in many situations.
Nathaniel, would you stay with us on the line? I want to go back to our callers. Let's go to, is it Siler City, North Carolina?
Yes, it is.
I pronounced it right. Thank goodness. Pete, thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you so much. It is a great honor to be on your show. And I want to share with you, I was in civil affairs and special forces and spent time as basically the de facto mayor of Jeremy, Haiti, when the Americans went in to keep the peace or whatever it is that we were supposed to do. And I'd like to share some of my insights from that experience, and that is the Army is pretty ill-prepared to deal with this nation-building kind of role. By design, the Army is an apolitical organization, and oftentimes much of the activities of nation-building surrounds around politics. The Army is trained to be aggressive and violent and to control, and what you need is some people to come in with some kindness and compassion, which the American soldier simply doesn't know exactly what to do. My experience was that the troops that were there, I was with a special forces unit, there was hostility towards the population.
But was there hostility towards you, though, Pete? Did they see you as separate from the military?
No, they didn't. They saw me as the representative. They saw, initially when we went into Haiti, it was one of the most moving experiences of my life. They looked at us as their salvation, the ones that were going to bring peace into their lives. And after a while, kind of a frustration set in because they realized that we were not their saviors. And there was a frustration on the part of the team because they were never exactly sure what to do. Our commander would go ahead and call up the higher headquarters and say, what do you want me to do? And the commander would come back and say, guys, you're doing a great job. Keep on doing what you've been doing.
Dana Priest, this is the sort of thing that you heard, right?
I have heard similar stories from everyone who's tried to do that. And I think if I could just pull out one thing you said that I think is so important to understanding the mindset that the military brings in. You know, you said it's taught to have to control and to use violence. And in nation building, part of it is giving up control to the locals who you don't understand. You don't understand their culture. They may be more loud than you're used to, and it may seem more chaotic. You may not have translators who can really describe to you what's going on. And as a result, people are so much on the defensive because they're worried about their own safety. They don't want to give up too much control because they're still the U.S. government, the U.S. Army in there trying to maintain order. The other point he brought up, which I've heard so much, is the commanders back home and in Washington, you know, they send these troops in. They say, your mission is create a safe and secure environment. But they don't give them instructions on how to do that on a daily basis. In fact, they almost want to leave it blank because if anyone gets in trouble, if anyone gets hurt, especially on the nation-building missions, then the commanders back home are going to get black marks against them by their commanders. And so they don't even see success in nation-building in the same vein that they see success during combat operations.
Does it mean, though, Dana, that if you took a former mayor from Poughkeepsie, New York, and said, how'd you like to go into this town or village in Haiti and help them kind of reorganize local politics, that you might be tapping into a layer of expertise in this country which the military can't duplicate in civil affairs?
Absolutely. If you ever sat in on a town hall meeting in Poughkeepsie, you will know that you have all sides, and some of them are angry, and some of them are trying to pull end runs, and you have to have a lot of patience. That's the other thing. A lot of the military guys, I mean, they just don't have patience to sit there and let these people vent, which seems to them a waste of time. But if you've sat through council meetings in the United States, you know that venting is part of the way you get to a negotiated settlement of even the smallest kind of issue.
Pete, thanks for your call. We're going to go next to Boston. Rob's joining us on the line. Rob, thanks for your call.
Hi, yes. I'm calling with just a couple of points. One is that I think this is a great idea, and I'd love to participate if I could in any which way.
What skill would you take over there, Rob?
Well, that would be perhaps an issue. I'm kind of a white-collar guy, not an engineer or anything like that, but it would be something in the lines of business consulting and finance, and might be able to help sort of a commercial sector get started and get going.
Well, that's lacking too, Dan, isn't it? I mean, from your experience in Afghanistan, you were there with the civil affairs people.
Absolutely. And one of the things that was so funny once, General Clark in NATO, he put together this was so typical of what an army reaction would be to this. He put together a computer simulated model of how you develop an economy. It's because he's using the same methodology that he learns to fight in battle there. But the reason he did it was because he realizes that standing up finance and commerce is essential to creating stable societies. So your skills are probably much more applicable than his.
Two other quick questions, having done a lot of listening while waiting on the phone. One is, I'm just curious what your guest thinks of SOFIA, the Support Our Friends in Iraq and Afghanistan program, which I'm only vaguely familiar with.
Sorry, I don't know that much about that, Rob.
It's just something I found.
I don't have time to go into it. We're only just a couple of minutes away from a break. Why don't you go to your second question? See if we can.
Sure. Second question is about this need for neutrality that a lot of NGOs talk about. I'm curious that if an organization like we're describing actually worked successfully, the lights went on, people got fed, businesses got started, how important is this neutrality really to the people we'd be helping, as opposed to just some sort of political need of NGOs themselves, for, their own sort of satisfaction or ability to sort of be in charge of themselves?
It's actually a great question for Nathaniel Raymond, and as I look at the clock, I'm going to say that that's where we'll start when we come back after the break. It gives me a chance to say thanks to Dana Priest for being with us. She is leaving the studio now. She has another engagement at the top of the clock and has to be off speaking somewhere else. So, Dana, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dana Priest is Washington Post national security reporter, author of a book called The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. When we come back after the break, more on keeping peace with America's military, whether or not the idea that's being booted around Washington now of a civilian force, perhaps under State Department instead of the Pentagon, might be something you'd be willing to sign on to, whether or not that would improve America's image abroad and the work of actual reconstruction. 1-800-423-8255. That's our number. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. One name for it is the Response Readiness Corps. Dana Priest likes to refer to it more as the Peace Corps of the 21st century. It's an idea that is being discussed in Washington now and being discussed on this program. You're going to hear a lot more about it. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Nathaniel Raymond is with us. He's also with Oxfam. And Nathaniel, I want to ask you to respond. I know it's a little bit since Rob asked his question, but he was really getting in on something which I know is essential to NGOs in a war zone, and that is the distinction, the neutrality that is so important to get the job done.
I think that, he put his finger on a really thorny question that a lot of us are facing now, especially in the case of Iraq, is what is the value of neutrality? What is the value of the Red Cross NGO Code of Conduct? And speaking as an aid worker, every day our staff in the field, especially in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, see the importance of being seen by local populations as separate, as delinked from the political and military agenda of other forces operating in a country. And again and again, as we're seeing in Iraq, with women who do the laundry at U.S. bases being targeted by insurgents, mm-hmm. any sense on the ground that a NGO staff member is somehow implementing a governmental agenda can, lead to events that end in death. And for us, it's not academic. And again, for those of us who have lost colleagues, especially in Iraq, in the case of the UN bombing and the targeting of the Red Cross, Red Crescent there, it is critical to try to differentiate, especially in Iraq, between those of us who are non-governmental, emphasis on non-governmental, and the Coalition Provisional Authority. And the way the actual structure of the occupation is set up, it's very hard to do that in this case.
And the need to find that kind of distinction is what brought these thinkers in Washington together under a sort of umbrella set up by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And one of those people was Bathsheba Crocker. She's a fellow and co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at CSIS. That's the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And she's joining us from the Christian Science Monitor radio studio in Washington, D.C. Sheba, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Tell me whether or not you think this thing's going to fly.
Well, I hope it will. It's definitely a very important first step. And as Dana was describing earlier, it's been a key missing piece all along. One of the problems is that, which was being discussed earlier, which is just the question that the U.S. military itself is not best suited to carry out these tasks. But another problem has been that because the civilian agencies in the U.S. government are just not up to the task at all and do not have the kind of standby capacity, resources, or coordination, or strategic planning capacities they would need, that a lot of these activities and responsibilities in post-conflict situations tend to fall on the military simply because there really isn't any other option.
And if you were to set up some kind of distinction, Sheba, where you have, okay, those guys are the soldiers, these folks are working with the whatever it's called, Rapid Response Readiness Corps, as a working title, do you think that it would be clear to the people on the ground, we'll use Iraq as an example, that all right, these people aren't necessarily with the soldiers, that they're more here to help us. I'm just trying to get an understanding of how it might work in a situation which is as volatile as Iraq, or maybe it doesn't fit that template.
Well, I think it's a very important question. I think it's also important to recognize that the significance of that distinction may be more important in the context of a humanitarian NGO than it would be in the context of, say, a U.S. civilian on the ground in Iraq. To the extent that U.S. forces, as forces and soldiers, are being targeted in Iraq, it is, of course, important to U.S. and other civilians working for the Coalition Provisional Authority not to be seen as too closely tied to that. But I think the reality is that any U.S. or coalition civilian working on the ground right now, perhaps with the exception of straight-up humanitarian NGOs, are in some way going to be associated with the United States. And if the opposition in Iraq is an opposition to a U.S. occupation, then I'm not sure it's going to make such a difference whether it's a U.S. military officer or a U.S. civilian. So I think that, you know, it's an important issue. And as we saw with the first deaths of the Coalition Provisional Authority civilians this week, which was so tragic on Tuesday with the death of Fern Holland and her interpreter and another person traveling in the car with them, it's clearly something that is of concern to the coalition and will continue to be, particularly if there are heightened attacks against civilians working there. But I think the really important thing to realize here is that we need to start setting up the U.S. government civilian agencies so that in Iraq, but also in future situations, because there will be future situations, we have a civilian corps that is more ready to handle the kinds of responsibilities and activities that we face in these countries.
Let's go to Darlington, South Carolina. Julia is joining us on the line from there. Julia, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I am a civilian who's also in the military. I'm a reservist, and I work in such areas as Fleet Hospital, and I work with Seabees. And we are sort of your civilian corps, except right now we're being funded through the Pentagon. Could we not be some of your sources for those civilians in the rapid response team and go under a different funding? Because we do set up hospitals. We do fix the mains and the waterworks. And we do have a section called the Army Corps of Engineers that does that road building, bridge building type thing. And we have the Navy Seabees, which do construction on a smaller. We have Fleet Hospital, which put up complete hospitals in hostile territory. So what do your participants think about using the reservist or transferring some of the reserve type units that would be in that civilian reserve response corps?
Julia, let me put that to Sheba Crocker, because that it's that distinction that I think is key to really understanding what's being proposed here.
Well, I think the caller raises a very important point, and one that Dana was touching on earlier, too. And, of course, we have to remember that in Iraq right now, to the extent that really any reconstruction is going on, a lot of it, a huge proportion of it, is being carried out by the Guard and Reserve forces who are there, and the Civil Affairs Unit and the units in the military police. So they are playing that role to some extent. But I think we also have to think about reconstruction in the full term of that word, and not only in the sense of reconstruction of physical infrastructure, for example. And the Guard and Reserve forces, the Marine battalions, the Army battalions that have been on the ground in Iraq are being asked to do everything from putting up physical structures, like building schools, building hospitals, building courthouses, to setting up local political councils, to civic education, to really starting to get towns and cities running. And although it's certainly the case that in your ordinary civil affairs units and in Guard and Reserve units, you will have occasionally people who do have that kind of experience. It was also the case when I was in Iraq over the summer and we went out into the field and visited with many of these battalions that we had a lot of soldiers coming up to us and saying, you know, we're sort of at the end of our ropes here, and it would be very nice
skill
if some
ropes?
Civilians got out into the field.
Do you mean the end of their skill ropes? They sort of can't do anymore?
Exactly, yeah. The end of their skill ropes, that they were being asked to do things like setting up local political councils and essentially running towns that they didn't necessarily have the experience to do. Now, there were the occasional ones, like there was a mayor. We met with this one soldier who turned out had been a mayor of a town in Colorado at one point, and so he did have the kind of experience that was needed, but he was probably more the exception than the rule, and they were really hoping that they were going to be able to see some civilians from the Coalition Provisional Authority get out into the field, and that's something that's just been really slow in coming this entire time.
Let's take another call from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. This is Dennis on the line. Dennis, thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to, I only got part of the program. I'm actually just redeployed here approximately a week ago.
Just back from Iraq.
Right.
Welcome home.
Thank you. It's good to be back. But my experiences, and I can only base what I have to say on my experiences, but because the military may have different perspectives, of course. But my experiences are, as a civil affairs soldier, is that there are a lot of subject matter experts, specifically in the Civil Affairs Corps, that are over there doing their job and trying to make things better for the Iraqi people. And at the same time, trying to mitigate and resolve any problems that could impact the military, which I think we were very, very successful in doing that. I found it very frustrating at times also, though, because of some of the problems that continue to happen, you know, soldiers being killed as well as civilians. One of the biggest frustrations is changing the mindset that the Iraqi have, the Iraqi people have, in terms of our perception of democracy versus their perception. The process, like someone mentioned previously, they've been repressed for so long, it's basically having to teach them how to be a good Samaritan, because in the past there were different elements of the regime that were responsible for that, that also was responsible for security. And so our Western perspectives are ours. And so we're basically trying to re-educate them and teach them, you know, the police, this is what the police are supposed to do versus this is what the police used to do. And the same with some of the other entities. City governments, that's a big challenge right there. There are some soldiers that don't have a background in that.
Right.
That makes it a little bit more complicated. But with civil affairs, there are soldiers from all walks of life, business consultants, lawyers, bankers, politicians, you name it, we're all here.
Right.
And so we bring that to the field.
There was a point that you made just a minute ago, and Dennis, I thank you for your call. I want to turn to Nathaniel Raymond here. You were talking about helping people learn to help themselves. And Nathaniel, you were telling a friend of mine here at the program about this water project work done by the German group, Architects for Peace. That would be probably a useful example of that kind of work, which can come from organizations that aren't part of the military, right?
Yeah, I think that's an important layer we need to bring into this discussion is how do we use U.S. capacity and civilian capacity to build local capacity and sustainable capacity in the countries we're talking about. In the case of the water main project you mentioned, Dick, Architects for Peace was able to do a water main reconstruction job for a fraction of the cost it would take for soldiers or for a contractor to do that same job. And there were Iraqis who are desperate for livelihoods, desperate for jobs, who need to be involved in the reconstruction of their own community. Time and again, nation building, the history of it is littered with failed infrastructure project after failed infrastructure project. You can build the school, but that school won't be maintained and filled with kids and a teacher if you can't get the community to support that process. And I think that's where NGOs play a critical role in building local capacity and getting communities to support these projects and not leave it another abandoned schoolhouse. And that's something that really needs to be the focus of this proposed Reconstruction Corps, not simply how do we use our human resources in this country, but how do we use them to get Iraqis and people from the countries we're trying to help able to do these projects themselves. It costs $276,000 a year, according to the Pentagon, to keep one civil affairs soldier in the field. That equals 50 jobs for local Afghan professionals, water engineers, health professionals, etc. And we need to figure out how to empower those people and fund them.
Sheba Crocker, when you talk about the ideas that are being raised with this response readiness corps, do you find that there's a real interest and a real appetite from among people in Washington that, hey, maybe this is the sort of in-between solution that touches areas that aren't being fixed now?
There is certainly a lot of enthusiasm, at least among certain parts of Washington, and I think that the experiences we're having in Iraq and Afghanistan make it very timely that this bill is coming forward now. I think those experiences, as well as others we've had in Kosovo, as Dana was describing earlier, and others that we've had throughout the 1990s, have just shown us time and again how much our civilian capacities lag in comparison to our military capacities. And I think the caller, who was the civil affairs officer, raised a very key point. And I don't think any of this is meant to denigrate the abilities of the civil affairs officers or the reserve and guard units who are out there. I saw them in action in Iraq, and they are doing fantastic work. And to the extent that there has been any progress in Iraq, it has been due to the flexibility and the amazing sort of experiences and other things that those units have brought to their work in Iraq. But I think that unless we have the U.S. military saying that it wants to and will train up enough units. I mean, the problem in Iraq is that there have never been enough civil affairs units. And if we're not going to build that capacity up in the military because we think it should be more of a civilian capacity, we need to turn to what we need to do in our civilian agencies. I think there is more of an appetite in Washington for this now. I think, in fact, that the uniformed military is quite enamored of the idea that we start building some of this up in the civilian corps because again, they are the ones who sort of bear the brunt of this. As General Anthony Zinni has put, the military tends to be the stuckey in these cases because our civilian agencies just aren't quite up to the task yet.
Sheba, I have to stop you there. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Sheba Crocker and Nathaniel Raymond there on the program. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. ¶¶